I'm not fat, I'm bloated.
That's good news for me. I'm not fat, I'm bloated.
That is very troubling that the All-Star Game may not be played tonight because of rain in the Cincinnati area. Because I'm telling you, from the moment I woke up this morning, all I was thinking about was the All-Star Game is just perfect to have on in the background. You don't need to pay close attention to anything. And I was going to come home.
I don't think advertisers like hearing that.
I was going to come home tonight and open up the windows in our family room because it's going to be cooler tonight. Put the TV on, sit down with a pile of work, bills and so forth and so on, and just maybe get a pizza, have the game on in the background, eat and knock off some busy work. And now, what am I going to do if there's no game? That throws my whole plan out the window.
Watch another program.
Yeah, but I need the All-Star Game is perfect because, you know, every once in a while I'll look up, see what's going on, I'll hear what's going on. I don't need to pay close attention to it. But I am interested in it, being a longtime baseball fan and a purist. An All-Star Game is still something that I can appreciate. Although
I do like
the pregame and postgame almost as much as the actual game. I like the festivities, and I'm interested in Pete Rose being there and all of that. What did you do yesterday?
Yesterday I did something that, as you know, I never do. I don't watch a lot of TV, except I watch by appointment only, usually. Besides the news.
What do you mean by appointment?
You know, like we watch Masters of Sex, so it's like whenever we want to, that's when we watch it. We do that for a couple of shows, but I barely watch.
Did you have to use that as an example of the shows we watch together? Why don't you
go
with?
There aren't that many. That's the one. That's your favorite.
Why don't you go with something less controversial? It's not necessarily my favorite. I kind of like it.
You love that show.
Why do you make things up? Now, I kind of like that show, but that I wouldn't put that in my category of my all-time favorite shows right now.
Well, it's the only show you want to watch with me.
I have ulterior motives for that, though.
Okay, but anyway, so what I did is what so many people do, and I never find the time to just veg out in front of the TV and watch unimportant programming.
And put your smartphone down. You can never do that.
So yesterday with our daughter, she and I sat, because whenever we're around you, we have to watch only certain things.
Like documentaries, Columbo reruns,
The
Honeymooners,
exactly.
Seinfeld.
Yeah, we have to watch all
Superman.
Of those. And if the TV is on in our house.
Leave it to Beaver.
It's got one of those programs on, and I'm sick
of them. Reruns.
So what we did is you were gone.
Yeah.
And we took over the TV, and we sat there and we watched one of those cooking, chef, Top Chef or Masters of Chef Master, whatever it is.
Yeah.
We watched one of those, and it was unbelievable. I mean, like, I know that I've seen parts of them before, and I've seen them over the years, sporadically, but it's just, like, unbelievable to sit there and watch, like, the time pass.
It's like junk food.
It's junk food, right. Mm-hmm. And then after that, we decided to watch Real Housewives of New York.
Oh, more junk food.
Starting with the first episode, which was years ago.
After you kind of watch it once to find out what it's all about and see if there's any good cat fights and women ripping their clothes off, then it's boring and it's phony. And how can you even watch it even as junk viewing?
It is fascinating.
Fascinating. Kind of a waste of time.
It was really, like, after the 40 minutes were over, I thought, wow, I just threw away 40 minutes of my night. But it was nice. It was fun to sit there with her.
Yeah.
And, just watch junk.
Yeah, but shouldn't this is what drives me crazy. We took her to see Spy, the Melissa McCarthy movie, which is, for the most part, is stupid. And, okay, once in a while, you want to take your 15-year-old to a movie like that, fine. But what's driving me crazy lately is time is passing. She's getting older. And when is she going to see To Kill a Mockingbird? When is she going to see Schindler's List? When is she going to see any of the great Jimmy Stewart movies?
Well, that's up to us to make her watch those. I mean, or it should have been.
Yeah, but
up
we
to
should
us.
Be doing that with the time we have with her instead of taking her to see these movies that she won't think about, 20 minutes after the movie ends.
But, Bob, it's not about the movie. It's about
going experience.
With her to see something she wants to see.
Yeah, but shouldn't she be seeing the great movies, the classics?
She saw the Amy documentary.
Yeah.
And
but
that was great.
Even
that
like Frankenstein, great. The Wolfman. She hasn't even seen the Universal Horror Movie classics
Bob,
yet.
How many 50-year-olds today have seen Frankenstein?
Not going to be like when I was a kid. These kids won't see those movies. That makes me very sad for them.
Well, why don't you get more involved in your daughter's life?
I try.
And say, you know what we're going to do tonight? We are going to see, tonight's a perfect night. She doesn't have any plans. You can't watch the baseball game. You are in
well,
the house
no,
with
I might
her.
Be able to watch if it's not rained out.
Okay, well, whatever. I mean, like,
okay, if the game's rained out.
Do it with her.
All right. Well, I did get her to watch Leave It to Beaver with me. She's hooked on Seinfeld now. That's a good, that's a step in the right direction. We've watched some Superman episodes together. Honeymooners. I mean, she's had a good base education from me. I've got to continue it, though, and now expand it into feature films. I have a hard time concentrating on what I'm doing here on the radio today, and I'll tell you why. Because Marianne is wearing something that is... The material just cries out, touch me.
That is...
It's absolutely true.
It's cotton. It's a cotton
dress.
Yeah, but
dress. It's... What is it? There's some...
It's a cotton
dress. It's doing something, though. It's hugging you. And
the problem is that you just saw Masters of Sex.
Stop that, will you? I know what that is made out of, what you're wearing. It's not cotton.
It's
felt. Watch this. It's felt. It's felt right now. I felt it. And also the colors looks very good on you, and it fits
Thanks,
really nicely.
Bob.
But it's not just a normal cotton dress, right? Isn't it a special something? Isn't it a special outfit of some kind?
It's not a special outfit.
What
Bob.
Is it?
It's just a regular dress. I got it like in a sports store.
Made
so
by
it's
who?
Like I don't even know. So I don't know who makes it.
You got it in a sports store?
Yeah, like it's like one of those like yoga dresses
or
something.
Okay.
But it's not a yoga dress. You wouldn't do yoga in this, but it was like in a store that had yoga, you know, clothes.
Mm-hmm.
I don't even know what store it's from.
Why don't you take a picture, a selfie, or we can take your picture so people can see what I'm talking about. We'll post it up there, facebook.com/SerrataMerciano.
They'll see it soon enough when we post our podcasts.
Okay. But it'll be on with all the pictures we post with guests and so forth today, right?
Yeah.
But why don't you, in some of the pictures, why don't you, like, stand in some of them with your back to the camera, some sideways, so people get the full view? And we'll take the pictures wide shots today.
I hope that wouldn't it be nice if whoever makes this dress paid us to talk about this?
Who made it?
I have no idea. I'll look at the tag.
Guys are going to want to know so they can get that for their, as we say among the deadheads, for their old ladies. We're going to take a break and then...
Thank you, Bob, for all the compliments.
Don't mention it. We're going to get on the medical watch, Dina Bear over at WGN. TV, and she's got some very interesting stories to share with us. Let's go over to WGN TV. Dina Bear on the medical watch. Hello, Dina.
Hey, Dina.
Bob, Marianne, how are you?
Good. And let's start off with this story about e-cigs. Does this mean they're more okay than we thought they were? What's the deal here?
At least according to this study. It's a big question, right? Are e-cigarettes dangerous to users? And it's been the source of some controversy because the popularity of that smoking alternative is increasing. So now airway tests reveal e-cigarette vapor produces a similar result in the lungs as air. So here's the comparison. 6 hours of exposure to cigarette smoke resulted in near complete cell death, but the same exposure to e-cigarette vapor did not affect tissue viability. The finding in the journal In Vitro Toxicology reveals e-cigarette vapor had no cytotoxic impact on the airway tissue. Now, this is not to say that e-cigarettes don't have some kind of biological impact on the body. They can contain nicotine, which, of course, is addictive. They've got other flavorings in them, but they do not produce smoke like traditional cigarettes. So while long-term safety studies are still lacking, researchers know at this point they're a safer alternative to smoking.
So, but we're not saying that they're safe, right?
We're not saying necessarily test the vapor. And they're saying that in the lungs, when they did these lung tissue samples, there was an effect that was similar to breathing any toxin that we might find in the air.
Another interesting study has to do with sitting and standing, and we keep hearing about how you just got to get up and move. You can't sit all day. It's no good for you. And now I knew this would happen, and it turns out standing is bad for you. Well, what are we supposed to do? Just lie down on a job?
I know, right? We've got to find a happy medium. How many times have I told you, get up while you're doing the radio, right? We've done all these stories on the danger of sitting. Some of the studies show that sitting all day is as dangerous as smoking for the negative health impact. But here we go. Standing too long is bad as well. Like sitting, standing in the workplace has long-term health consequences. I didn't realize this one. Nearly half of all employees worldwide are required to stand for more than 75% of their work days. And of course, that can lead to back problems, muscle strain, leg cramps. The greatest danger is for people who stand for 5 hours or more at a time. So the recommendation, take seated breaks, put your feet up, and make sure that at least one of those breaks in a five-hour period is for a half hour.
I'm just getting a bed in here. Just do the show in bed. We're always trying to include plenty of protein in our diet because everybody knows that we need a lot of protein. And this is a good story about a new source for protein. What is this?
Yeah, I don't know that I'm convinced about this one. Hungry for protein? Try some algae. Algae is evolving as the next new alternative protein source consumers are anxious to bite into. Well, that's what the nutritionists are saying anyway. It's being added as ingredients in crackers, snack bars, cereals, and breads. The conference is called Where Science Feeds Innovation. It's hosted by the Institute of Food Technologists right here in Chicago, and experts showed off some of the samples. They're comparing this to quinoa. We've gotten used to that. We've been eating that, considered a protein, a strong alternative to reduce meat consumption, limit food waste, help feed the growing population in the world. Get this, algae contains 63% protein, 15% fiber, and only 4% carbohydrates. So we'll see how we're going to spice this up. Marianne, you're the great cook, so you come up with a great way to make this taste good, and we'll try it.
Algae omelet, maybe?
Yeah, I haven't seen how it comes. Is it a powder? Is it flakes?
Well, they're adding it in all different ways, depending on the food that it's going to be in. So, you know, I imagine you could bake it like a kale, but it's being added to crackers. They're adding it to cereals, all to boost that protein level. So,
yeah, who's going to be the first restaurant around
here?
Add
it to your black bean recipe that I saw online.
There you go.
I wonder what happens when you cook it, when you heat it.
There's going to be a restaurant offering an algae salad. You know that's going to happen here.
Well, you can already get that, I think, in some restaurants, right?
Well, no, I think it's just on the floor right now, growing in the closet.
Algae does not grow on the floor. It grows in the ocean.
Oh, that's right. Sorry about that.
Yes, we're getting it out, we're cooking it up, and we're getting a good source of protein, we think.
We think. Okay, it's the Medical Watch, Dina Bear at Channel 9. Thank you,
Dina.
Thanks,
Dina.
Thanks. Have a great week.
Talk to you next week. I'm calling to order an emergency meeting of the Serrat and Murciano Book Club because this new book is so tremendously interesting. We must dive into it immediately, especially with all of the news recently about the Apple Music service being launched. This book is called How Music Got Free, The End of an Industry, The Turn of the Century, and The Patient Zero of Piracy. Stephen Witt is the author. He spent some time here in the Midwest. You were at the University of Chicago, weren't you, Stephen?
Hi, Stephen.
That's right. That's right. I was, 97-01.
And before we get into your record collection, let's, so to speak. Yeah, so to speak. Let's talk first about what I know about all of this, which is really very little. It seems to me one day I was buying albums, I was buying vinyl, then I was buying CDs, then Marianne gave me an iPod, and I had my music there, but I didn't like the quality, and then all of a sudden CDs started disappearing, and people were streaming music, and the record companies were crying and whining about it. And basically, is your book just taking us through what happened and why it happened?
Yeah, the focus of this book is really the transition from the compact disc era, which is, let's say, 82 to about 98 or 99, into the digital online era of today. And for a long time, that meant the destruction of the music industry because they hadn't figured out how to package and capture this stuff. And then finally, sort of at the end of that era, finally, in the last couple of years, they started to recapture some of the ground that they've lost. So it's a survey, but it's driven by these characters.
I remember during the days of Napster, I'm not sure what years that started, but during the days of Napster, when people started getting used to the idea that they could just share music and not have to purchase it, that I heard a lot of talk back then that the record companies should have gotten in front of that, and they didn't. Now, would that have been possible to avoid everything that happened since then?
Maybe. They certainly could have taken better steps in the early days. You know, the MP3 is academic software from Germany. Its inventor is a guy named Karl-Heinz Brandenburg, who took advantage of basically inherent flaws in the human ear to create this thing that could compress a CD to about, you know, one-tenth the size. And that's what an MP3 encoder is. But he was locked out of the marketplace for a long time. He sort of had the Betamax of audio technology. So in desperation, he posted that to the internet in 1995, and the pirates got a hold of it. By the time I showed up at college, as I said, in 97, the campus servers were awash in pirated files. I probably collected hundreds of thousands of these things over the years.
But pirates did not exist,
and Brandenburg,
right?
Had, what's that?
Pirates didn't really even exist then. I mean, didn't people, like, learn how to pirate the music?
Yeah, they sort of had to teach themselves, in fact. It was all teenagers. You know, it was kids in chat channels in the mid to late 90s who were figuring out how to do this. Among those kids actually were Sean Parker and Sean Fanning, the guys who sort of came up with Napster, which debuted in 1999. But before that, they'd been using this kind of jerry-rigged academic software to rip files. In the earliest instances, because broadband wasn't there, they used to take like a compact disc single, maxi single, rip it using an MP3 encoder, and then port it across like four floppy disks. Then they'd send those disks through the mail. That's how it started.
I remember some years ago talking to John Mellencamp, and Mellencamp said, and he named a mutual friend who was running a record company at the time, and he said, well, this guy just started to fight the pirating, and instead of doing that, they should have gone in a completely different direction. What direction would have worked, in your opinion, Stephen?
Here's what happened. Brandenburg took his encoder to the recording industry in 97 and was like, you guys got to get ahead of this. And the recording industry types were like, well, you know, we don't really believe in digital music distribution. What they didn't realize is that they've been doing digital music distribution since 1982 with a compact disc. They just didn't have the right paradigm. The difference, and I say this in the book, was that when they looked at those racks of compact discs at the mall, the retailers and the executives thought of it as inventory. But to a computer scientist, it's just an array of data that should be served more efficiently from a centralized computer server. If they'd made that realization 5 or 10, and that's where we are today, but if they'd made that realization 5 or even 10 years earlier, and they could have done so, they would have saved themselves a lot of pain. But I think they were addicted to the profits of the compact disc.
And what about television, film, and other media? Did they learn from what happened to the music industry?
Yeah, they were able to head it off a little faster. It's kind of striking that Netflix video on demand actually sort of became more popular before music streaming services on demand did, if you think about that. It's kind of ironic, right? You would expect that music, which is much easier to stream, would have happened first. But it just shows how misaligned the record company executives were. The movie industry has done a better job from it. But today, they're actually still really threatened. If you go and look where a lot of piracy is happening, it's on cable companies, TV shows, and movies. That's really where it's moved. So they're still in trouble. They're not out of the woods.
Is it really possible to be able to avoid piracy? Because aren't there always, I mean, if there's technology out there, isn't there always going to be a way for other technology to figure it out, like a puzzle?
I compare the whole thing to the war on drugs. It began in the 90s with this generational wide shift about attitudes, about how to pirate music, where you could get it, and really a violation of existing law and social norms. You know, so then the industry came up with a war on piracy, and they've been fighting that ever since. But those wars tend to be unwinnable. They're very hard to stop because exactly for the reasons that you outlined, the technology is always there and it always keeps evolving. And they can't control the flow of information on the Internet, not completely.
Millennials are buying turntables. They're appreciating the wonderful sound of the old vinyl that we grew up with. But it's a minuscule market and it's not really leading anywhere, or is it?
It's probably not going to. It's about 4% of the overall music market in the U.S., about 2% globally. You know, maybe it could hit 5, but it's not going to be 20. The fetishism for vinyl, I understand it. It's nice to own something, you know. It's nice to have something in your house. Just the same way with books, but I don't really see making it a huge comeback.
Am I the last person in the world who cares about the quality of the sound and hates the compressed sound of these files and longs for the days of, well, CDs weren't even that great, but that wonderful sound that vinyl gave us?
Yeah, there's a subculture of people who agree with you. It's about 2% of the overall market.
2%, great.
You're with the 2%, Bob.
Here's the difference, and let me explain to you why people don't care that much. There's a trade-off, okay? There's a trade-off between audio fidelity and mobility, right?
Yeah.
So if I give you the choice of having your vinyl record player in your house, your perfectly constructed acoustic cave with your speakers and your tube amps, Or, that's one alternative. Your second is I give you a phone with a click wheel and you can listen to it while you're running through the park. About 98% of people are going to choose the phone.
Oh, you know, yeah, not Bob, because Bob likes to run carrying his turntable.
No, I carry a boombox, Stephen. I got a big boombox. That's why I'm in such great shape, because it weighs 80 pounds. But can't we have both? I get that. And when I'm out running, I do want my portable music. But then when I'm home, and nobody's listening to music through speakers anymore, I don't understand why people don't want both.
Well, they have to pay twice. And most people are unwilling to do that.
I'm all for not paying much, that's for sure.
Don't you always have to listen to music through speakers?
No.
I mean, no matter.
Yeah, well, even a headphone is a good
thing. But I'm talking about, you know, we had the Kef speakers and Jensen and all those great companies.
Yeah, but they got smaller. I mean,
the market's not there. People have decided they want to spend their money differently. They prefer to listen to, and this has always been true, actually. If you go back and look at the history of audio, sure, there were always those big, fat speakers who were fantastic sound and the vinyl and all the sort of like high quality analog equipment, but the first and still one of the best-selling mobile devices in history was the AM transistor radio, and that thing did not have good sound quality, but people loved it.
You know, right. Remember the Walkman when that first came out? How great it sounded! And I wonder if you go back and listen now, what it would sound like. But the man, it sure was terrific at the time.
Yeah.
I think he's laughing at you.
I think most people would prefer the MP3.
Yes, I think so. And has the quality of the MP3, hasn't that gotten better? Because I feel like I used to be able to hear, you know, detect the difference, but I don't detect it as much anymore.
That is absolutely the case. What's happened is that in the early days, they were really trying to preserve bandwidth. Remember, we sort of take it for granted now that we always have these like gigabit transfer, you know, very fast internet in our homes. But if you think back to the 90s, that wasn't really the case. A lot of people were still using dial-up. So they compressed the files a lot more in those days just to be. Today, we don't have those limitations. So although the format itself hasn't actually improved, you can compress it less and get higher audio quality. So it's not an illusion what you're hearing. It does sound better.
One of our listeners just sent a text, and I actually want to know the answer to this question myself. But the question is, what is my best option to download music that is not iTunes? And my question would be, is iTunes really the best?
iTunes is fine. Your best option if you really want what are called FLACs, and these are sort of perfect bit quality copies of compact discs, is to actually go on the pirate networks. It's the only place that's really available. But for most people, actually, I recommend they subscribe to a streaming service like Spotify. It really is a much more elegant solution. And once you start paying for one of these things, you'll understand why there's so much hype about it. You just have everything, a library of 30 million songs always available. You know, I was a serial pirate. I had 10, 12 drives full of, you know, pirated files that I accumulated over 10 years. But when I subscribed to Spotify, I realized, God, this stuff is all worthless. I just have this library instead. It's 30 million songs. And you can stream it in high fidelity if that's what you want.
And you're paying for it, so you don't feel bad that you're paying for
it. And you're no longer a criminal. So.
Exactly. But people in the music industry, they're always fighting this because they feel like that it's not, that the money's not going to the artists themselves enough. For what Spotify is.
I wanted to get to that, the free streaming sites now, and what that's done to the core economics of the business. I mean, the music industry, they're trying to rely now on advertising rather than record sales for their revenues, I guess.
Right. Well, actually, now they're trying to get all of the music majors are trying to get away from the ad-supported streaming for exactly the reasons you outlined. You're really getting pennies from that stuff. So the big culprits there are Spotify's sort of non-subscription ad-supported tier, and then YouTube. And YouTube is really the big culprit. It acts like the world's jukebox. 29 of the 30 most viewed videos on there are sort of viral music videos. But they generate very small amounts of money. The amount of money you collect from those pre-roll advertisements is just very tiny. So it's really not contributing in a significant way to the growth of the music industry.
However, if you
have somebody paying $120 a year, and 70% of that is being paid out to rights holders, that equates to about $85 per consumer per year. That's a lot of money. It's actually more than most people spend on albums in a given year.
Okay,
so they should be able to get something from that.
But what do you mean by that? Because my question is, are the artists able to make the money? Because you see so many people, like, for example, Taylor Swift saying, I'm not going to have my music on Spotify because the artists are not paid fairly in comparison to what, say, Spotify makes. How do you feel about that?
Well, here's the big difference here's the big thing. If you subscribe to Spotify, you more or less stop pirating completely. But you also stop buying albums because you already have everything that you need. For a long time, this isn't so true for Taylor Swift, but for a long time, artists were sort of able to over-earn using one or two hit songs to fuel million or even multiple million selling albums just on the basis of one or two songs. And most of the songs on those albums were never listened to. Now, on Spotify, that doesn't happen. You only get paid as an artist for exactly what people are listening to. So you don't get to collect those sort of profits on songs that you wrote but nobody cares about. So having a hit on Spotify is actually a lot less profitable than it was during the album days, where you might get, you know, a million album sales just on the basis of one good song. And remember, the albums are selling for $14, $15 a pop, whereas in the download era, it's more like 99 cents. Mm-hmm. So that's what's really hurting them. But the disaggregation of the hit song from the album, or what the music industry calls unbundling, that's here to stay. We're never going back to the model of the 90s, which allowed them to earn so much profit for so long.
The book is How Music Got Free, The End of an Industry, The Turn of the Century, and The Patient Zero of Piracy, Stephen Witt. I want to get to that very interesting untold story of the music piracy revolution and the mysterious man who almost single-handedly took down the music industry. It wasn't you with your 15,000 pirated albums, was it, Stephen?
No.
Oh, okay.
I was the consumer.
All right. Wolf with Stephen Witt right after this. We're talking about the book, How Music Got Free, The End of an Industry, The Turn of the Century, and The Patient Zero of Piracy. Stephen Witt spent about 5 years of investigative reporting in order to write this book. Let's get to that Patient Zero of Piracy. Who was it, Stephen?
That was a guy named Del Glover. He worked at a compact disc manufacturing plant in a small town in North Carolina. And he worked on the packaging line, so the compact discs would come in and he would feed them into a shrink wrapper. What he realized pretty quickly is that he sort of had access, literally at his fingertips, to the hottest music of the year, weeks and sometimes months before it was going to appear in stores. So with his confederates, he devised a scheme to smuggle this stuff out of the plant. Over the course of about 7 years, he leaked about 2,000 albums out of it, including most of the major hits of the era. This would be stuff like Eminem, Kanye West, Taylor Swift, who we mentioned, Mariah Carey, all these massive selling artists. He'd bring them home to his home computer and rip them to MP3, then upload them to a sort of worldwide conspiracy of people doing the same thing all over the globe. From there, it would quickly make its way to public peer-to-peer file sharing sites like Kazaa and LimeWire and Napster. And within about 24 hours, you could find this stuff on iPods around the globe, well ahead of when you could ever find it in a store. So in this way, he sort of became the patient zero of music piracy. Almost all those illegal files that existed in the 2000s, and I'm sure many of your listeners had these on their hard drives, can be traced back to just this one guy.
And what happened to him? Do we know?
We know. He sort of did this for a long time, and the FBI was aware that people were doing this, but it was very hard to catch them. You know, the way a criminal conspiracy works online, it's almost the opposite of the way organized crime works in the real world. So let's say take the mafia, or a classic organized crime family. You know, it really is a family. A lot of those guys are related, and they grew up in the same neighborhood. Online, it's almost totally different. Everyone's hiding behind pseudonymous handles and encrypted chat channels, and they don't know anyone else. In the group, they only talk to them online in the chat channel, but they don't know any details. So even if you catch one of these guys, it's impossible to get them to flip on the other ones. This made Dell very hard to find because even though the FBI kept trying to get these groups, they couldn't get inside to this one guy. They finally caught up to him, and I won't reveal how. You'll have to read the book for that. But they finally caught up to him in 2007. And in 2009, he pleaded guilty to a conspiracy to commit copyright infringement.
And finally, the concert business today. How was that affected by the change in the recorded music business?
It was helped massively. That's where the real growth occurred all through that period. What had happened was that the sort of total availability of everything at a very low price actually turned a lot of people into big music fans. And in particular, it freed up a lot of money in their entertainment budgets to go to more concerts. We also saw people starting to blend genres. So in the old days, maybe you were just a fan of one kind of music. You're a rap fan or a pop fan or maybe a metalhead. Now everyone sort of seems very content to inhabit different, multiple genres at the same time. And that leads to the success, where they have this large variety of totally different musicians from totally different genres, all headlining the same festival. And those generate a ton of money, especially for artists, actually.
What was the toughest part about putting your book together? You have so much information in it.
Yeah, structuring the information was tough. The hard part was really, as you say, just getting it all together. Most of the reporting stuff, you know, it's not like I had to break into anybody. Everybody was pretty willing to talk to me. And Dell, actually, no journalist had ever talked to him before. The harder part was making sure that the narrative was there, that you could start reading the book and that you'd really get to the finish with it. And the way I did that was to try and structure it around these characters. I had a lot of fun researching and reporting this book, and if I'm lucky, I've managed to convey some of that fun to the reader.
Well, yeah, you did. Were you the kind of kid who grew up taping off the radio, Stephen?
Sure. I was. I used to tape Casey Kasem's Top 40 Countdown all the time, if you remember that show. I think it might still be on satellite radio somewhere.
Yeah, sure. They keep running the old shows. Well, it's a really, really interesting read, How Music Got Free, The End of an Industry, The Turn of the Century, and The Patient Zero of Piracy, Stephen Witt. Congratulations, and thanks for talking with us, Stephen.
Thanks, Stephen.
Thanks so much for having me, guys.
What happened with that New Horizons mission flying by Pluto? Let's find out from the Adler Planetarium. Astronomer Dr. Lucianne Walkowicz is with us, and she appears through the courtesy of Bill and Wendy, I might add. Doctor, thanks for joining us. How you doing?
Hi, Lucianne.
I'm great. Thanks for having me on.
This is a huge day for Pluto lovers, right?
I think it's a huge day for everybody. It's probably a huge day for Pluto itself.
Yeah. What happened this morning exactly?
Well, this morning, after about a decade's worth of travel, the New Horizons mission reached within just a couple thousand miles of the surface of Pluto, literally flying at over 30,000 miles per hour through the Pluto-Charon system.
And do we know yet whether the scientists and the mission people are happy celebrating over what they're getting back?
Well, you know, the thing about visiting the very most outer portions of our solar system is that it takes a really long time to get that information back. And as we all know, you're not supposed to text and drive. So right now, New Horizons is doing all of its science, and our scientists, the science team, is probably on pins and needles waiting for their phone home, the downlink that we're expecting tonight, that will indicate that New Horizons has passed through the system successfully, which will be followed by those first look images.
From what we've seen so far at a further away distance of Pluto, what are the amazing things that we've learned that we did not know before?
Well, you know, the best comparison I've come up with is that this is like seeing the face of a relative that you've heard about your whole life and never seen before. Mm-hmm. Even the Hubble Space Telescope images of Pluto, just because it's so far away, have sort of made it look like a mushy pea for basically the entirety of human history. And so now even these closer images that have been taken, you know, a couple million miles away, we see incredible amounts of detail. We see craters, cliffs, things that look like bright patches, dark patches. And so we're about to get this first detailed view. Now, you know, what can you tell from a picture? Well, all of that stuff will be compared with the kind of geology that we see on our own planet and on neighboring planets in the solar system, which will tell us a lot about Pluto's history and therefore the history of our own solar system.
I remember as a kid, it seemed like the only thing we really studied about Pluto or heard about it or learned about it was it was very tiny.
And cold.
And cold, yeah. That's going to change now a little bit, isn't it?
Well, it's still going to be tiny and cold.
Yeah, we'll know more, though. And this this thing was launched, what, like 9 years ago?
Yeah, just about 9.5 years ago. It takes a really long time, even when you're one of the fastest human-made objects in all of history. It takes a really long time to get to the outer portions of the solar system.
Okay, so now, first of all, was New Horizons' mission to get to Pluto, and is that it, or does it continue on?
Yeah, what happens to it now?
Well, so New Horizons is truly a Pluto flyby. So it's not going to go in and orbit around Pluto. It's basically, you know, sort of taking all of its paparazzi shots as it flies through the system. And then it's actually going to continue onward. So here at the Adler, just back in January, we had Alex Parker, who's one of the New Horizons science team members, who works on what New Horizons will do when it finishes flying past Pluto and continues out into the solar system. Pluto is one of what we call Kuiper Belt objects. So the Kuiper Belt is this collection of icy worlds, you know, little icy worlds that live in the outer portions of the solar system that are the leftover building blocks of the solar system itself. So as New Horizons moves outwards, it will continue to study basically Pluto's family members, all these Kuiper Belt objects that are out there.
Is there ever any hope that something completely unforeseen, something nobody ever thought of, will appear in one of these pictures?
Well, we've literally never seen anything like these pictures. These are completely unprecedented in human history. We've never seen the surface of Pluto. And so we've really already seen something that we haven't seen before, and we'll continue to see that in the pictures that we'll get back just later this week.
I think Marianne's hoping for aliens, Doctor.
Well, I'm not sure that we'll see anybody, you know, waving from the surface of Pluto.
Yeah.
But one of the things that gives Pluto, if your listeners have seen any of the pictures, Pluto has this really cool-looking coppery color. It's almost reminiscent of Mars, but on the surface of Mars, that red color comes from literally rust, iron oxide. And on Pluto, it's actually this sort of organic molecule gunk, this stuff that is caused by ultraviolet light from both our sun and from space itself shining down on the surface of Pluto and creating these long chain molecules. And that doesn't sound that exciting probably on its surface, but the reason that we care about those things is that we think that some of those long molecules, those big complicated molecules, are the kinds of things that might have been precursors to life before life ever formed. And that's really why we study the outer portions of our solar system, is that this is the pristine material that was left over from the formation of our solar system. So it's kind of like space archaeology.
So and how does studying Pluto and the smaller ice worlds that are out there, and for that matter, all the other planets, how do scientists apply that to Earth?
Well, you know, one of the things about Earth is that we have very active geology here. You know, we have these oceans and weather, and we have volcanoes that are active. And so actually it's kind of difficult to study the history of Earth in many ways, because the surface of our planet literally resurfaces itself. One of the things that we can do on planets and other worlds, whether they be moons or dwarf planets that don't have that active geology, is that we get this sort of frozen in time picture of what that planet's geology looks like. And so that allows us to relate what we see here on Earth to what we see on those worlds. For example, the fact that the moon has craters all over it is something that tells us that in the early portions of our solar system, early in time, there were lots of things flying around and impacting Earth, Moon, and the other planets of our solar system. And we think some of those impacts might have even brought water to places like Earth that have lots of it. But it's hard to see craters on the surface of our planet because our planet resurfaces itself all the time. But that record is preserved in the face of the moon.
Will the New Horizons spacecraft continue on for years, Doctor?
Yeah, I mean, New Horizons will just keep going, much like the Voyager spacecraft, which was launched in the 70s and is also, I think, might be the record holder for coasting speed at the moment. So Voyager was launched in the 70s and only really left the solar system just about a year or two ago. So New Horizons will keep on coasting and studying the outer portions of the solar system as long as it's alive.
Powered by solar?
You know, that's a good question. I believe it's mostly powered by solar, but I'm not totally sure.
Anyway, but what you were saying about it continuing on, at what point does it stop sending pictures, and or can it just forever be sending pictures?
Well, the challenge is really that downloading data, it's sort of from the outer solar system, it's sort of like a really, really bad internet connection. It's why those first look images that will come to us will be only a teaser of the high resolution images that we'll get later this year. It takes 4.5 hours roughly for light to even get to us from the New Horizons mission, and that's why it takes a long time to download it, along with the fact that the rate of data that you can transmit is not very much. So, you know, imagine being around somewhere with a really, really bad Wi-Fi signal. It would take you a long time to download images, right? So as long as NASA and New Horizons can communicate, it can get, you know, location information, little like blips, much like the phone home signal that will come tonight that will let it know that the spacecraft itself is alive. But actually downloading images is a little bit more difficult and more time consuming. Mm-hmm. So it's still possible, it just might be slower.
Was the New Horizons at any time visible to the naked eye?
I would imagine when it was launched it was.
And that was about it.
I don't think it has been for a while.
incredible, the story of the guy who discovered Pluto being from Streeter, Illinois, and at one point you had him at the Adler Planetarium years ago, right?
Yeah, we actually have in our welcome gallery here at the Adler this week a wonderful exhibit on Clyde Tombaugh, the discoverer of Pluto. And, you know, he actually shares, well, Pluto shares a discovery birthday with the opening of the Adler Planetarium 85 years ago this year.
Adler's America's first planetarium.
It is.
And just to clarify, now Pluto was a planet, then was not a planet, and now is a dwarf planet? Is that what we're calling it now?
Yeah, so Pluto is a dwarf planet. Basically, what happened is that the outer portions of the solar system are really, really faint. All of these worlds are very cold. They don't shine like stars do. Planets are intrinsically hard to study because you have to have light bouncing off of them and reflected back to you in order to see them. So in the case of the outer portions of the solar system, it's difficult to actually discover and study the things that are out there. So many years ago now, Pluto got its label changed. So it got a title change. It was not, you know, kicked out of the solar system or anything like that. But it was changed from being a planet to being a dwarf planet because other worlds that are similar to Pluto were discovered, other dwarf planets. So now we think that Pluto has more in common with those worlds and is part of this family of dwarf planets as opposed to being a planet itself.
And then those dwarf worlds are is that going to increase what we call our solar system in names, for example? I mean, are we going to have more than 9 planets?
Well, we have 8 planets, but many dwarf planets. And so as we get better at exploring the outer portions of the solar system, the Kuiper Belt and beyond, we're going to find more of these worlds. And so we're going to have an ever-growing family of dwarf planets.
It's astronomer Dr. Lucianne Walkowicz. And by the way, the Adler Planetarium, I was reading in Crane's Chicago Business List of Chicago's most eligible singles. They were interviewing these men and women. And I think one of them mentioned that the best place for a date is the Adler Sky Show. So there you go. And if you're a high school or college student and listen to this entire interview, you do get a science credit, a summer school science credit for this. and again, the doctor appears courtesy of the Bill and Wendy Show. Fascinating stuff.
Thank you so much.
Well, thank you very much for having me on, and I'm so looking forward to seeing those first look images.
And we'll see you at the Adler Planetarium. Right. Thank you, doctor.
Thanks.
Thanks very much.
July 14, is summer starting to feel like it's about to get away from you a little bit, or have we had so much cool, wet weather you don't even think it's summer yet? I was thinking about this today when I watched someone jogging. They were running and talking on their phone while they were running.
That's what you were doing yesterday, weren't you?
Me?
Oh, you and I were going for a fast walk, and you were on your phone.
Well, I got a call while I was out there, but normally I don't like to do that. Now, what we did last night after dinner, which is go out for a walk, although you tricked me, Marion says, we'll go out for a walk, and I think, yeah, I wouldn't mind going around the block a few times. You know, an hour later, sweat's pouring off of me, but it did feel good.
Walk.
And that is a way to slow down summer. Well, we've been talking about this, how to make it last, how to not let it get away from you, how to keep an eye on summer before it's too late. And one of the ways to do it is to not yap on your phone when you're out there jogging or walking. Just breathe. Smell the flowers. And from time to time, I like to share with you some of these articles I've kept over the years that all basically are about the same thing. Keeping the season from fading too fast. Seizing moments for pleasure. The other day, we were reading about mind tricks for a lasting summer. And then I also mentioned the Mary Schmeek column she wrote a while back. I think it was... This is like a year ago, about how to make the summer seem longer. And today I want to share this with you. It's from a column that was written by Barbara Brotman in the Tribune a while back. Headline, "Don't Underestimate the Power of Doing Nothing." See, that's what it's all about, slowing things down. Let me read part of this column. What peace and pleasure can be had simply by taking in the world around you. You can think, you can daydream, or you can simply enjoy the wondrous show. But, Barbara Brotman writes, don't take my word for it. Take Walt. Ready for a little poetry? Do we have any of Franklin McCormick's old music here behind me? Now I will do nothing but listen, to accrue what I hear into this song, to let sounds contribute toward it. I hear bravuras of birds, bustle of growing wheat, gossip of flames, clack of sticks, cooking my meals. How do you say bravuras? That's why Franklin McCormick had a successful show for so many years here, and I don't. Anyway, you get the idea, right? do nothing. Don't. And you, Marianne, you go out and you're just constantly on the, not talking necessarily, but you're, I don't know what you do. You're in a chat room or something on your iPhone while you're out there jogging and walking.
For the record, our walk last night, mm-hmm. 45 minutes of that walk on the phone.
Well, because I got a call. It was kind of like an emergency.
Well,
it wasn't like I'm making calls.
It wasn't like an emergency.
Well, you know that it was
45 minutes.
It was a call that normally I wouldn't even answer my phone, but you make me bring it.
But then the next day you sit here, and after you were on your phone for 45 minutes of the hour, you have the audacity to come here and sit here and tell me that I'm on my phone.
But what was I supposed to do? Hang up? It was an important call.
But I didn't even bring it up until you started bashing me. It was like, what? I wasn't even on the phone.
I was talking about a woman I saw jogging, talking on the phone today. I wasn't talking about you or me yesterday.
And by the way, I glance at my phone because my Fitbit is attached to it.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of times, for some reason, it just stops taking into consideration my steps. So then I refresh it, and then it starts working again.
So those things aren't accurate anyway. Hasn't that been proven? They're not accurate?
Well, I see it as I take each step. Usually, I see it counting a step. How is it not accurate?
I thought I read that they weren't really accurate.
You want to know how many steps we did yesterday?
Sure.
On our walk alone, it was 8,000-something. Just 8,000-something. But then it was almost 13,000 steps, you know, for me at least, for the day.
The last 500 steps of our walk, that was not fun for me. I had enough. I like to walk more leisurely when I go for a walk. Although they say to get some benefits, physical fitness benefits, you need to walk like you're late, you're going somewhere and you're late.
We were walking like we were late.
I know.
I like that. That's why we were sweating.
For too long.
Marianne's Celebrity Report to the Nation is on the air.
Thank you, Bill Curtis. It is sponsored by Hollywood Casino Aurora and Joliet. Now we switch to the Celebrity Report to the Nation anchor desk, where Marianne is sitting and begins her report.
All right, here we go. Medical examiners have found no evidence to prove that B.B. King was poisoned before he died of natural causes back in May. So these are the official results of the autopsy, and they were trying to figure this out because two of his 11 children said that their father had been murdered. But the autopsy did show that the cause of death was Alzheimer's disease plus physical conditions including coronary disease, heart failure, and the effects of type 2 diabetes.
But no poison.
So now we put that to rest. And... oh, you know what? 50 Cent is now talking about why he filed for bankruptcy, and reporters are snooping, and we're getting a pretty good look at the whole picture. And so now this is what happened. He filed for Chapter 11 just 3 days after a judge had ordered him to pay a woman $5 million in damages after it was determined that he posted a sex tape online without her permission back in 2009. So the move of bankruptcy looks purely strategical. And, you know, he was saying yesterday that he's taking the necessary precautions that any good business person would take in his situation. And then he goes on to list notable people who filed for bankruptcy, such as Walt Disney and Donald Trump.
Well, so, I guess he didn't want to pay that woman.
He did not want to pay the woman, apparently. Whoopi Goldberg is drawing back her Bill Cosby support.
Finally.
Yes. And she says now that the evidence points to guilt. And she was talking to legal analyst Dan Abrams today on The View about the allegations. And one of her questions was, as a serial rapist, why is he still on the street? And she is having a change of heart because of her lack of knowledge about the statute of limitations for filing for rape charges. And now she's all informed, she says, but she still believes that you're innocent until proven guilty.
Mm-hmm.
Jimmy Fallon, now did you hear about his finger incident?
Yeah, apparently it was really serious.
Yeah, apparently he almost lost his finger. And he was in ICU for, I think it was 10 days, and his finger almost had to be amputated. So he went back on the show after a two-week vacation, 10 days of which he spent in ICU, and he explained what happened. So what happened was that he was in his kitchen, and his wife had bought this rug like a shag sort of rug. Mm-hmm. I forget the word he used to describe it. And he tripped over it. So to break the fall, he put his hands in front of him, but his ring got caught his finger off. And then to say, the condition is called ring avulsion. And he says, don't Google it because you'll be completely grossed out. But this is what he said about it.
Apparently the odds aren't great with these things. This happens a lot. And the odds are not, usually they're just going to cut your finger off. So I was going to lose my finger. And I was like, wow. So this guy did surgery for like 6 hours. He's microsurgery. So it's like under a microscope. He had to take a vein out of my foot. It's the craziest story. I go, you got to be. I mean, I didn't know this was happening because I'm just knocked out. He took a vein out of my foot and put it in there. And if you attach it, you have to, the veins only work one way. They go this way or that way. So he has to make sure. You're so happy I'm not your doctor.
Veins
go this way or that way. Yeah.
The wrong way.
Get this guy with me. So we have to remember where. And then if you're putting it together, if you do one misstitch or something like that, the vein closes up and it's useless. And you screw it up and it's not going to happen. And he did it. And he saved my finger. And it's now, you can see it's pink on the end. It was white like this color. And so he saved my finger. I won't get feeling back for 8 weeks, he said. I was in the ICU for 10 days. And I got to say, the nurses over and the doctors at Bellevue Hospital, thank you so much for taking care of me. Oh, my gosh. I love you guys.
And did you see him? I mean, he's still all taped up.
Well, yeah, his hand is taped
up. He's giving people high fours, he said.
Yeah. It sounds unbelievable what happened to him. I mean, and he describes earlier on, and we'll post the whole thing on our Facebook page, but he's early on describing that, you know, he falls and he looks at his hand and he sees that his finger is completely sideways, and he just couldn't even look at it, so he wrapped a towel around it and didn't look at it again until he got to the hospital, and he said, I think I broke my finger. And that's when they said, oh, no. This is not a broken finger. This is a ring avulsion. And, you know, he's like, what?
Ring avulsion.
Yeah.
The name for it?
That's the name for it. And apparently it's not that uncommon.
Well,
be careful with those rings.
When Jimmy Fallon was talking about that and thanking his doctors, I just kept thinking, he's still, you know, he's a big Letterman fan. And he thought, well, let's see, Letterman, you know, talked about how when he had the heart surgery and he had the doctors on, this will be my my heart bypass moment.
Why
with
do you
my
have
finger.
To think that?
I don't know. I couldn't help but think about it when he was talking about it.
Okay. Taylor Swift. Okay. So she was performing in D.C. last night, and she had a surprise guest on her show, Lorde, who came on stage to sing her hit Royals with her, and it was supposedly a really great moment, but then there was a stage malfunction.
Uh-oh.
Moments after Lorde appeared, and you can hear a little bit of what Taylor Swift is saying when this stage malfunction.
She was
what
stuck.
She says, right before that, she says, they just told me in my ear that I might be stuck up here forever, she told the crowd. This thing is broken. So, and if you look, we'll post that too. If you look at it, she's in this contraption, like on like what appears to look like a second level on the stage, and then it wouldn't go down. Apparently, it was all fixed in time. But, you know, one of those things that happens, and you have to make do and ad lib and figure it out.
And she did.
And she is one to do so, so smoothly. Okay, remember that video that went viral with the woman walking through New York City getting catcalled more than 100 times?
Yep.
Okay,
yep.
That woman is now suing the people who made the video for $500,000 because she says that she the clip got more than 40 million views and that she's not saying she didn't get paid for the gig, but she didn't get what she was promised. Now, the problem is that she did not have a written agreement with the director, Rob Bliss, and Hollaback. They aren't being very specific about it, but she's also suing Google, YouTube, and TGI Fridays, which parodied the catcall video for one of its ads.
But she made the video, didn't she?
Yes, but she supposedly had an oral agreement with them.
Oh.
And did not get what was supposed to be coming to her. Remember yesterday we told you about Cindy Crawford's lookalike daughter, Kaya Gerber? Well, she not only signed on as a model, but she also is going to be acting in a movie. She's 13 years old, and the film, it's an indie film, it's called Sister Cities. So this 13-year-old has now started her modeling and her movie career.
This is bound to happen.
Yep. And if you want to see what Lady Gaga looks like in American Horror Story Hotel, well, you know, this was such a teaser. I could not wait to see what she looked like. And I played the clip, and it's, well, I mean, you do not really see her. But it's the first time that she's appearing, and it's just a claw. It's a 10-second teaser of her claw. So we'll see what that's all about. You know that I can't wait for American Horror Story to start.
I know. All women like that show.
And here's something that's going around.
All men hate it.
That's not true. Here's something that's going around everywhere. People just can't get enough of this story. And it's Bethany Frankel. And the question is she dating Modern Family star Eric Stone Street? You know, the guy who plays Cam? And there's a picture of the two of them being shared, going viral everywhere. And, well, she's not saying much, but it appears that maybe they're just friends. Who knows? She made a funny remark about it on social media, but she didn't say. She just said, wow, so many boyfriends, so little time, is what she wrote in the post.
All right. Well, maybe. Well, what's going on there?
Some game.
Pre-game all-star. Anything else in the celebrity report?
No, I think that's about it.
All right, let's move on then, shall we? We'll take a quick break, and we'll quiet down the fans, and we'll open up the Surratt and Murciano mailbox next. It's the feedback department, and let's open up the mailbox. And we're still getting many texts and emails and Facebook comments and trail mail about the book on back pain, Marianne, that you keep talking about. So once again, what is the name of the book, and who is the author?
Oh, it's called Healing Back Pain, and it's by Dr. Sarno.
S-A-R-N-O. Dr. Yeah. Sarno.
Yeah. It's really changed my whole outlook on not just back pain, but any pain.
Yes, and no matter what pain I complain about now around the house, the answer is always the same.
Read the book.
And I always take that to mean it's in your head. It's not really a pain. And I always say, no, it's real.
No, that's the whole thing about the book, is that it is created by your head, but it is a very real pain. It's not an unreal pain. I mean, it's very, very real.
All right, Dr. Sarno, and the book is called
Healing Back Pain.
Okay.
I'm reading another book of his now.
Oh, great.
Because I'm done with that one.
What's this one?
I forgot what the name of it is, but it's like something about the mind-body connection.
Mm-hmm.
But you'll see it if you look for Dr. Sarno.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
I'll find the name of it.
It's just another reason why I won't get any sympathy around the house. That's
exactly.
All I know.
Hey, let's get to some texts. 708 says, sunburn relief, use white vinegar. It will take the sting out. Don't laugh, it really works. Our daughter was looking for a solution, and she Googled it, and she found this concoction yesterday that...
Baking soda.
I think it involved baking soda and white vinegar and sugar and something else. I don't know what. 847 says, time for Bob to buy another TV for the rest of the family.
What do they mean by that, do you think?
Because you always force the entire family to watch only your certain things that you like.
No, nobody watches with me anymore.
Yes, because we've all, we're all going on strike. We can only watch certain things if we're with you. You won't watch anybody else's junk, right? But you want everybody to watch yours.
Yeah.
Get another TV. 407 says, Bob, you need some Beats headphones. That's because you were complaining about the quality of music.
Yeah, but I'm talking digital. About compressed files as opposed to listening to something on speakers. Doesn't even have to be vinyl. But I thought the Beats, the whole thing with Beats was the marketing and the way they looked, and that the audiophiles don't really think that much of Beats. Not true? We'll hear about that. We'll find out.
Not everybody is an audiophile.
Okay.
You know, this is why you can't relate to our daughter, because you explain that to her, and she says, I don't care, I just want Beats, and I want them to be green.
I know. Fighting a losing battle.
You are. 309 says, Bob, I agree with you. I'm 25, and I love the warm hi-fi sound that vinyl and a great sound system provide. MP3s are convenient on the go, but the decreased sound quality is almost distracting. I think
See?
You guys have not... listen to MP3s lately, it's changed.
When our daughter is in her 20s, then, you know, she'll relate to me, because I'm all about people in their 20s. But you're right. No, some files have changed, because they have some categories of compressed music, and it's like, I don't know what they call them, but it's better compression, and it's a better sound that you get in some cases.
And 309 says, on the plus side, lately whenever I buy a vinyl record, there's usually a code provided with it so you can download the album digitally without having to pay twice.
This is all about the conversation we have with Stephen Witt, W-I-T-T, and that book again is How Music Got Free. It's a really, really good book.
Okay, 618 says, don't say don't Google it, because you know we all did. You didn't mention the wrist avulsion in the images. Wowzer. Now, I don't know...
Well, wait a minute. Back up. Translate that for me. What's this?
Because Jimmy Fallon was saying, don't Google ring avulsion.
Oh, okay.
Because it's really, disgusting, right? So this is, this person who sent us the text is agreeing. And then 630 says, I don't know if... They sent a picture... of their ring of avulsion results.
Please don't post it.
And I'm not going to post it, but I don't know if it's even true or if it's that they removed his ring finger digitally on the picture. It's really very, very disturbing.
Thank you.
Yeah. And
anything else in the mailbox?
we have... So many nice people have written so many nice things about that black bean, the quick shortcut to delicious Cuban black beans that I posted on our Facebook page. But so many people agree with me, Bob, that we need a new kitchen and that I need knives. Now, those two things are so true. And I'm gonna be making more things.
We've got zillion knives in the house.
I know, but they're like butter knives.
No, we have some good steak knives. Some nice ones.
Somebody was giving me a hard time because I was using a steak knife to chop up the onions and the garlic.
Okay, well let me deliver a message.
And that's because those are our sharpest knives. What is wrong with us?
Deliver a message to all those people who have left comments like that criticizing our kitchen or the silverware.
No, most of them are very nice.
I want to see what your kitchen looks like, okay?
Send us a picture.
Yeah, post that. Is that it for the mailbox?
Yeah, that's it.